as is the case in a single human life, there is a moment of birth and there is a moment of death that frame its beginning and its end. Along that trajectory, between these two marks, are many moments of birth and death, many moments of beginnings and endings. This is the human journey. It is the human evolution. Evolution is a response to the environment. And our environment is always changing. So too are we ever changing. Our bodies grow and age, our emotions are expressed and honed and refined, and our minds are applied and strengthened. And so we call this our maturing, our human evolution. As Unitarians, we know that questioning, thinking, and learning from our human experience is an essential part of that human journey. This morning, I am particularly interested in the evolution of the journey of the Unitarian movement, and specifically, the journey of our principles. The Unitarian story has evolved along that sort of twisty path of many questioning minds. We are proudly the heretics and the visionaries and lots of regular folks who are committed to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Even our principles, which today are a core to our faith community, have evolved over time. Responsive change is at the very center, the very core of our tradition. So before you go to sleep, we're going to turn the lights on. I know you're sensing that I'm going to get into some history, and that's true. But before we do, I would like us to reflect for a moment on our principles. Now, if you go to the back of your order of service, if you have one, the principles are there. Or you can open up the gray hymnal and see what's there. Now, what was really interesting in the reading that we just did from the gray hymnal, this was printed at one point in that journey. And if you notice, there was a principle that was not there, which is, sorry? Okay. I am embarrassed. I thank Renee for leading the charge. And I wish the rest of us had followed her. So my point was, simply, just backtrack. The principles have changed. The seventh principle is there and was there at the time of the printing of the gray hymnal and exists today. So you've had a chance to look through it. And my question to you now, I primed you before, was to think about the principle that calls to you right now, that has some energy for you. And I'm putting you on the spot. I'd like you to turn to somebody close to you and share with them one of those principles that means something to you. So you've got about a minute or so to do that. Have a little conversation. And I will encourage you to have this conversation, continue it downstairs over lunch, and encourage people that have been Unitarians for a while to go up to someone that might be new to Unitarianism and have a conversation about the principles with them. The one thing about Unitarians is we do love to talk, which is a good thing. Question and talk. Now, a religion needs to be able to say to the world that it stands for something. And these seven principles, and you can see after them there are the six sources, are the latest in a long line of attempts to frame what is common between us. A frame that holds our proud diversity together and says to the world, this is us. So how did we get here? How did we get to this point of having seven principles and six sources that frame who we are? Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists emerged out of Christianity during the time of the Reformation. Now, I know there's some of you who are history buffs will know that there are roots before that. But we'll start there at the Reformation. At the Reformation, we were the dissenters and the heretics in those history books. Our ancestors were the kinds of people who did not go along with the crowd. We could never be told or accused of being sheep. Unitarians first established themselves during the Reformation as nones. We were non-Trinitarians. We were the Christians who, on considered and rational grounds, declared that God was one and not three, because we could find no clear mention in the Bible that God was divided into three parts, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. It was just a rational conclusion. These non-Trinitarians became the heretics in the Christian theological history for not accepting a triune God, nor the divinity of Jesus. We also thought that, no, Jesus is not God. Jesus is a man and a great teacher. One thing our ancestors didn't like being told was that they could not question the doctrines of the church. But they did, and many of them were thrown into jail or burnt at the stake for stating their convictions. In the 19th and 20th century, our ancestors could be found in one place, the Church of England. But again, they were the folks in the Church of England, in the established church, who were questioning the faith and the creeds of the denomination. The Church of England needed to preserve its authority, even though it had switched back and forth from Protestantism and Catholicism. They still were the established church, and they needed to preserve that authority. So they had very little toleration for those who had an alternative point of view. Yet even in that established church, when there were enough individuals who had evolved in their faith into a different understanding of God or a different understanding of the nature of Jesus, they could sometimes establish their own congregation, as the non-subscribing Presbyterians did in Ireland. Canadian Unitarianism has been influenced by those non-subscribing Presbyterians and non-conforming Church of England folk, and also significantly by the development of the Unitarian and the Universalist churches in the United States. The principles have been influenced by the European side of our theological family and the American side. The principles and purposes that we looked at together are our most recent attempt to frame what we uphold as essential to our living together. In the old days, this would be called a statement of belief or a confession of faith. In 1803, the American Universalists created what was called the Winchester Confession, which clearly stated their faith, which was God will finally restore the whole human family of mankind, or the whole family of mankind, to holiness and happiness. This statement stood out in direct contrast to the Calvinist doctrine, which declared that some would be saved, some would be burned at hell according to God's will, and what you did or didn't do had no influence. Universalists were all about universal love and universal salvation. So a clear branding in our modern term for the new religion in America. Now, was it a creed? Did you have to believe it to be a universalist? Well, it was repeated in the churches, and it was taught in the Sunday school. So yes, it was a creed, even though this was debated. And you'll see this thread through our history, especially in the modern era, as Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists negotiate that gray area between having a statement of belief that holds them together and defines them, but not wanting to have a creed that might force someone out if they believe something different. This is a natural tension in our community. As the Universalists were emerging and defining themselves in a unique way, the Unitarians, because they hadn't blended together yet, the Unitarians at the same time, they were reluctant to do so because they, at the time, were the establishment church. But it was only a matter of time when those young whippersnapper, up-and-coming young ministers who were asking all those questions started to state publicly what they believed. So between Ralph Waldo Emerson's sermon at the Divinity School address in 1838 and Theodore Parker's sermon on the transient and the permanent in Christianity, the very foundations of Christian Unitarianism were being challenged, and a new definition of Unitarianism was coming forth. For 20 years, that was known as the Radical Controversy. This debate between the old school Christian Unitarianism, the new emerging understanding, which was being influenced by the Transcendentalists, the fight over the identity of what exactly a Unitarian faith was. 20 years it went on. Now, the first time we hear about the principles was during the Second World War. And they were created as a means to secure and advance Unitarianism. We'd lost an awful lot of people going into that war. A lot of disillusionment went through our community. And so we needed something to be that clear statement of who and what we stood for. A. Powell Davies and his Unitarian Committee was charged with framing a statement that would set the foundations for this growth. So I'm going to read you these five principles. This was the very first go at it, and you might recognize something, some seed in them of what we have today. Individual freedom of belief, discipleship of advancing truth, the democratic process in human relations, universal brotherhood undivided by nation, race, or creed, and allegiance to the cause of a united world community. Second World War, the first principles. When the Unitarians and the Universalists merged together in 1961, these five principles were then incorporated into the new Unitarian Universalist Association Statement of Purpose. Only 9 years later, in 1970, these principles had become, quote-unquote, uncouth. Or at least the language was no longer relevant to the members of the Unitarian Universalist Association. And we give thanks to the women's movement for this. Out of the women's movement came the understanding of inclusive language. And that launched an initiative to change the principles. In 1977, at the initiative of Lucille Shuck Longview and the UU Feminists, the General Assembly of Unitarians and Universalists adopted a resolution calling on its members to examine their own religious beliefs and the extent to which these beliefs influenced sex role stereotypes in their families and in the religious movement. The revision process was put on the General Assembly's agenda in 1981 through a series of amendments, because it wasn't just sexist language. The Pandora's box was opened. One amendment included the sexist language changes, wanting to take out brotherhood and mankind. Another suggested changing foundation and fellowship to center and community, because the former was felt to reflect a hierarchical structure and community was understood to have more heart in it. Another concern with the existing principles was that it didn't reflect the valuing of the wholeness of life. And so another amendment suggested adding an acknowledgement of our responsibility to cherish the earth and its resources. The last amendment, and perhaps the most controversial, was concerning God and the Judeo-Christian heritage of this tradition. There was a movement to take God out of the principles. Well, the amendments were mailed out to everybody across the entire continent, Canadian, American, everybody. And the firestorm began. Traditionalists, Unitarian Universalist Christians, environmentalists, feminists, humanists, they all began positioning themselves. The Reverend Carol Scrovel wrote in a public letter, "The impending debate on whether or not to amend the principles so as to eliminate the word of God has every prospect of becoming the kind of contest in which, regardless of who wins, our association will lose." As Denise Davidoff said at the time, the amendments didn't have a prayer of passage. And so, at the 1981 General Assembly, the whole bucket of amendments was sent to committee to be worked on. And this was actually a stroke of brilliance, because it meant they avoided the changes, the amendments being defeated. And it recognized that changing the definition of who we saw ourselves to be in the world as Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists, what needed to be done with incredible care and thoughtfulness and creativity, and it needed to include as many people as possible in the formation of the new principles. The process took about 3 years. And every congregation in Canada and the United States had the opportunity to be involved. This in itself, the inclusion of everyone, demonstrates the Unitarian principle of democratic process. And it also demonstrates how, in our polity, Unitarians are congregationally based. We are not hierarchical. We are not told from someone or some group above us what to believe. It is democratic. Thus, in 1984, the next version of the principles was birthed, but not without the excitement of a last-minute change on the floor of the assembly. The first six principles were familiar, but the wording of the seventh principle, and the favorite of many today, respect for that interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, it had not been anticipated. Yet, according to the Reverend Walter Royal Jones, who was head of this committee, its inclusion was overwhelmingly supported in the responses received from the churches and fellowships. And its current happy wording emerged from the floor of the assembly, where it was instantly recognized as just the right language. I can just imagine the huge excitement on the floor of that assembly, and the relief when in 1984 those principles were adopted, and the responsiveness and thoughtfulness and inclusiveness that is a hallmark of how we are together. Great example of this living tradition that we are a part. Now, of course, what's interesting is the change in the principles, it doesn't stop there, as you can probably already imagine. But it doesn't stop there, because built into the very fabric of our bylaws is a bylaw that says that we need to revisit these principles no less than every 15 years, whether we are satisfied with them or not. Now, at the General Assembly in 1995, there were more changes. And I will invite Reverend Katie Stein Sather, past Minister of Beacon, to tell us what happened, because she was there.
I joined the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly Planning Committee in 1987, just in time to see the backstage story of the rise of feminist theology within the movement and the adoption of the sixth source of inspiration as part of our purposes and principles. That year, I was delighted to join a chanting and drumming circle hosted by the Covenant of UU Pagans. One of their invited program speakers that year was Matthew Fox, the about-to-be-defrocked Catholic priest who promoted creation spirituality in defiance of the Pope. By the following year, 1988, the mainstream humanists, especially the more adamant of them, found this goddess spirituality stuff to be too totally irrational and incomprehensible that the preacher of the highlighted and high-powered service of the living tradition, in so many words, dismissed such nonsense with much disdain. To my knowledge, the pagans didn't bother to try to debate this theology in the way they might have done in earlier centuries. They just invited the really big names to the next General Assembly the following year. Starhawk filled the biggest lecture hall at the hallowed Yale University, Yale being that bastion of Orthodox Christianity opposed to Harvard Divinity School, which was more Unitarian. So Starhawk filled the big lecture hall. Other pagan speakers had big crowds too. The idea of a goddess, of a divinity, totally unlike any of the traditional God previously espoused in either Unitarianism or Universalism, was making the rounds generally and gaining ground among Unitarian Universalists, especially women. The theology of panentheism, the idea that divinity is in and beyond the universe, was becoming popular. Even though the Oxford English Dictionary refused to list the word, I tried to tell them they should. The principles and purposes and sources had not been in place long enough that they felt unchangeable at this point. Been adopted in 84 and 85. The pagans and panentheists wanted to add a source of inspiration to the list of sources that follows the principles themselves. They wanted paganism or earth-centered spirituality to be recognized as a source of inspiration. Passage was not a foregone conclusion. For many of the humanist majority, this was anathema. Again, it's a two-stage passage process. 50% of the delegates are required to pass it the first time, and a two-thirds majority the second time. My time on the planning committee finished in 1993, the year the gray hymnal first came out, and I checked the copy I was using earlier, and it has only the five sources. The first year of passage was 1994, the next year. Then the second year of passage would have been the year that a two-thirds majority was needed. And that year, General Assembly was in Spokane, Washington. Debate, vociferous debate, centered on whether it was legitimate to have such a bad theology on our official list of sources. And the language had already been broadened to be more inclusive, less focused on feminist theology specifically. A primary memory of that debate is the passion engendered, especially on the part of those who needed this to be included. It did indeed pass, at least partly, it is said, because of the location of General Assembly. It was in the Pacific Northwest District with big nature all around. I believe this debate and the rise of women's spirituality gave everyone permission to be theist if they so desired in a different way than had been traditional. For many of us, earth-centered spirituality is not only embedded within whatever we term mainstream Unitarian Universalism, but articulated specifically as well. Katie.
In the very core of this religion, this living tradition, beats, I think you've heard it, a heart of change. Another of our members, Bev Locke, was also at the event that Katie was describing, And she told me how electric the atmosphere in the building was after that vote to accept the earth-based religions as the latest of our sources. Bev remembered how excited everybody was and how there were spontaneous circle dances breaking out in hallways as the celebratory energy swept through the building. It was an exciting time. But so it was in 1984 and 1961 as well. In 2002, the Canadian Unitarian Council officially adopted the Unitarian Universalist Principles and Sources and added a French translation. You can go to the Canadian Unitarian Council website and see them there. They struck a task force to look at whether we wanted to change these principles to reflect a Canadian sensitivity. The workshops, the surveys, the conversations lasted for about 5 years, and it was in the end concluded that there was widespread support for the principles as they were. Most recently, in 2009, a revision, you remember that bylaw every 15 years? So a revision of the UU principles and purposes was created and proposed. And what's interesting, it was defeated by 9 votes. And one of the reasons given for defeating a change was because they had taken that 6th source out. The one that Katie was describing, earth-based religions. The journey of the principles is really kind of less than 100 years now. And yet the roots of our responsive, thoughtful, and inclusive tradition reaches back 400 years. When speaking one's mind and challenging the status quo often meant imprisonment and death. We've come a long way. My final challenge is to you. Do not take your freedom for granted. In the human journey, the freedom to believe what your heart and conscience moves you to has been encouraged and protected for a relatively short period of time. And though it may be hard to believe, this freedom may not last. So, have you been evolving in your free and responsible search for truth and meaning? How's it going? I encourage you to think deeply on this and to really consciously embrace this journey that you're on. The principles are the very best framing that we Unitarians have made up to this point to hold our diverse community together, but also to hold us individually together. These principles, they can be your support. You can lean into them because they are pulsing with the lives of thousands and thousands of people who have thought and imagined and struggled to articulate and negotiated and affirmed so that each of us today can touch and be supported by this living tradition. It beats with the dreams and the hopes and the heart of a people of faith. And they are us. I thank you for listening.